All right, listen carefully. I know that we are in the laboratory room right now, but what I'm going to cover in this recording is both laboratory and lecture material. You need to know this stuff for the lecture exam and for quizzes and practicum. And I'm going to, as part of this recording, I'm going to go through three slides that I would normally have given you upstairs. So those slides are already part of the third chapter of the unit, so they won't be posted separately. They're just part of that chapter. I want to talk about transport processes, and specifically processes for transporting things into and out of cells, which I just barely started talking about today upstairs, right? How many did I say there are? How many categories? Three. But I've only talked about one, which was vesicular transport, right? And I covered that already upstairs. That's not relevant to what we're doing here. It's important. That's one of the categories. But the other two categories are unlike vesicular transport because the other two categories do involve whatever it is being transported actually going through a membrane, either into or out of the cell. And those other two categories are active transport and passive transport. Now, these are distinguished on the basis of energy requirements. And the one that really applies to what you're doing today is passive transport. But I don't want you to think that passive transport does not require energy. If you've learned that, that's not correct. Nothing gets transported for free. Both of these require energy. But passive transport has that energy that's required already built into the system, which I'll explain more about in a minute. So there is no requirement of additional energy for passive transport. On the other hand, active transport does require an outside source of additional energy. Otherwise, it can never happen. All right? Now, the rest of the time, I'm going to focus on passive transport. But passive transport is a little bit potentially confusing because passive transport is a directed process, by which I mean it's the transport is in a particular direction, even though it happens because of random movement. So we're talking about solutions here, specifically liquid solutions. So you're already familiar with liquid solutions. But a liquid solution is a population of particles. There's at least two different kinds of particles, right? Solvent and solute particles in the mixture that we call the solution. But it's a population of particles. Actually, just consider one type of particle at the moment. You have a population of particles. And those particles are randomly moving, meaning each individual particle is moving at its own speed and it's in its own direction. And they're bouncing off of each other, which will change the direction and speed. But that's what I mean by random. And that overall random movement of particles is called Brownian motion. All right, so that's the randomness of it. What I said is potentially confusing is that passive transport occurs in a particular direction, even though it's caused by random movement. To understand that, just consider a chamber in which you have a bunch of particles, but they're all grouped tightly together just say in the center of this box. And this would really be in three dimensions, but the same concept applies to two dimensions. If, and I have the clock stopped at the moment, so nothing's really moving here, but these particles, if you allow time to go, are moving. Each individual one's going at its own speed in its own direction. Now, if the any of these particles is going to be able to leave this group, a couple things have to be true. One is that a particle would have to be at the edge in order to actually escape. Because all these interior ones aren't going to get very far. They're just going to knock into another particle. Does that make sense? But it's not enough to just be on the edge. You also have to be a particle that happens to be moving at the moment in a direction away from the group. If you're on the edge and you're headed inward, you're just going to collide into something else as well. But if you are a particle that's on the edge and happen to be moving in the right direction, that particle will leave the group, go off on its own. All right? And that, and if you come back later and look, you no longer have a high concentration of particles in one place and a low concentration of particles everywhere else. Now instead, you would have particles evenly spaced out pretty much, still randomly moving, but there wouldn't be a place where there is high concentration and a place where there's low concentration. So that's what I meant by the direction of movement. Passive transport always moves particles from a place of high concentration to a place of lower concentration. Even though the particles individually are going in random directions. Now I said that even passive transport requires energy. And I said that the energy for passive transport was built into the system. To explain that requires the definition of the word gradient. Gradient is a real general term that really just refers to a difference in some measurement at one place compared to another place. So here, before the clock starts on this box, we have a gradient here. Because in this place, there's a high concentration of the particles. Here, there's a low concentration of the particles. So that's an example of a gradient. And since the difference that's being measured here in two places is concentration, that's specifically a concentration gradient. There are all kinds of other gradients, like pressure gradient, for instance, is why water always comes out of the faucet, not goes in. And there's electrochemical gradients. You know, you put a plug into a receptacle. What we call the voltage is really a gradient of electrical energy or electrical potential energy. So there's all kinds of gradients. But here we're in this experiment. And for cells in general, we're concerned with concentration gradients. And passive transport always occurs, well, I should say net passive transport, meaning the movement as a population, not as a single particle, always occurs from high concentration to low concentration in that direction. Which is why if you started with all these spread out, they would never passively go into a concentrated group. Now, another way of saying that passive transport occurs from high concentration to low concentration is to say that passive transport always occurs down the gradient from high to low. It's possible to move things from low concentration to high concentration, But you have to force them to do that, and that's what active transport is. That will never occur on its own. You have to force that to happen by introducing external energy. Well, the built-in source of energy that drives passive transport is the gradient. And I want, this is the first time I'm saying this in the term, but I'm going to say it many times, so I want you to remember this. Anytime that you have a gradient, not just concentration, there's other gradients as well. Anytime you have a gradient, that gradient is a form of potential energy. Meaning that it's possible to allow that gradient to do some work. In the case of passive transport, the work that's performed is the movement of the particles down the gradient. All right? Now, passive transport in general is called diffusion. So if you let this picture represent molecules of table sugar, sucrose, that's in a sugar cube, and there's water molecules, but they're just not shown. So you plunk sugar cube into water. At the very first moment that happens, there's a very steep gradient, meaning a big difference in concentration. There's two gradients, though, because there's two types of particles. The sugar gradient, though, it exists because right now there's a very high concentration of sugar here and a zero concentration everywhere else. So that's a big difference, a steep gradient. At the same time, though, there's a concentration for water particles because there's a lot of water here and there's no water here yet. Well, diffusion just refers to the spreading out of particles by leaving an area of higher concentration and going to an area of lower concentration. And that's what you know will happen if you put sugar cube into water, right? You come back later, it's no longer a sugar cube. It's dissolved sugar because the sugar particles have left that group and have spread out as much as they can into the water. That's diffusion. Now, that's the simplest case of diffusion because we just have one compartment. But diffusion can also occur through a membrane. And that's what is happening in today's experiment, by the way, because you're working with cells, right? Potatoes are made up of cells. And you already know that each individual cell has a plasma membrane. In the sugar cube example, there's no membrane involved, but that's still diffusion. Diffusion can, though, occur through a membrane as well. And when it comes to membranes, membranes can be selectively permeable. And that's what plasma membranes of cells are. Permeable by itself means able to permeate, and permeate means go through. So selectively permeable means that membrane allows certain things to go through it. Certain things can permeate, but other things can't. The plasma membrane is a selectively permeable membrane. Let's go to these pictures. So I want to get through three slides from the slideshow that are highly related to today. Here we have on the upper row, this is one box. It's the same box, but in three different points in time. And notice this compartment, this box, is subdivided by this dashed line. The dashed line represents a selectively permeable membrane. Now, it's not only selectively permeable, but it happens to be permeable to these orange dye molecules. they're able to get through the membrane. Well, the picture on the left is at time zero, before anything has happened. It's frozen at the moment. And notice that there is a gradient in place. Let me state specifically, before we go on with this example, that in order for diffusion to occur, and really when I say diffusion, I should be saying net diffusion. In order for net diffusion to occur, and net diffusion means movement of a population of particles in one direction more than another. For that to occur, though, there have to be two things in place. First of all, there has to be a gradient. And the gradient is the tendency for those particles to diffuse. The reason that they would move in one direction more than another is because they are grouped together more concentrated in one place than another. So they want to spread out from that place. So you have to have a gradient, otherwise there's going to be no net diffusion. A gradient itself, though, is just the tendency. There's another important requirement, which is that there has to be a way for that particle to get from point A to point B. The gradient is the tendency, and there's always going to be a tendency to move from high concentration to low concentration. So the gradient determines the direction. But if the particle has no way to get from there to there, it won't happen. Okay? Well, in this case, both requirements are met. There is the gradient in place, because it's high concentration on the left, low concentration on the right, the gradient exists. And since this membrane is permeable to these molecules, they have the ability to go from A to B, from left to right. So they will. And as you let this happen, more and more molecules will leave the high concentration area and go to the lower concentrated area, which means the gradient is being diminished over time. And if you wait long enough and come back later, there will be no gradient left because the concentration is the same on both sides of the membrane. You can say there's no gradient, or you can say the value of the gradient is zero because there's no difference in concentration anymore. And when there's no more concentration gradient, there is no more net diffusion, right? I already told you that a concentration gradient is required for net diffusion. But that doesn't mean anything stops. When this comes to equilibrium, because the gradient has been completely diminished, all of these orange dye particles are still moving randomly and in their own direction and speed. But since there's no gradient, it's just as likely that that particles will move from right to left as it is for them to move from left to right. So, yes, they're still crossing the membrane, but there's no net diffusion because there's not a movement of particles as a population more in one direction than the other. The water molecules are in this, they just aren't shown separately. But importantly, water molecules have their own gradient, and any different kind of particle, whether they're solutes or solvent, each individual category of particle has its own gradient, which is independent of all the other gradients. The only thing that makes one type of particle tend to move in one direction more than the other, in other words, to diffuse, is that particle's own gradient. So the water, if you looked at the water molecules as particles, they would be moving more so in right to left than left to right. They're just not shown for simplicity. In the bottom, you have two different kinds of solutes. So the same thing is shown that I was just talking about. purple dye and orange dye, both of which are permeable to this membrane. But we start out on this bottom left with two separate solute gradients, right? There's an orange dye gradient and a purple dye gradient. They don't have to do with each other at all. They're independent. The only reason orange is going to go from left to right is because of the orange gradient. The only reason purple is going to go from right to left is because of the purple gradient. And they can come to equilibrium, as you see here. Okay, that's still diffusion. It's just a little bit more complex than this sugar cube example because there's a membrane involved. But notice, the only thing the membrane complicates is that it's possible for a membrane to not be permeable to a certain kind of particle. In which case, that kind of particle might have a gradient and therefore a tendency to diffuse, but it doesn't fulfill the requirement of being able to get there. So there won't be any diffusion in that case for that type of particle. Okay. In slide 11, we have a special case of diffusion. So diffusion and passive transport are really the same thing. Diffusion is always passive. But there is a special case of diffusion, which is still diffusion, but we give it its own name in this special case. And that special case is called osmosis, which is really what you're studying today with this experiment. So osmosis is diffusion. But in order to call the transport process osmosis, two things have to be true. One is that the particle that is osmosing, or being moved by osmosis, is solvent, not solute. Now, if you read just about any biology book, it will say specifically it's water. Technically, that's not true. It could be any solvent. There are other solvents besides water, but in biology, the solvent is always water. That's why biology books say that. But for the sugar cube example, there's movement, there's diffusion of water here, which is solvent, and there's diffusion of solute. Well, even the solvent diffusion, when the water goes toward the sugar cube, that is still not osmosis, even though it's solvent, because that's only one of the requirements. The other requirement for it to be osmosis is that those solvent particles need to be moving through a selectively permeable membrane. There is no membrane involved here, so even though water is moving down its gradient and it's solvent, that's still just diffusion of water. Any questions on those definitions? Then let's look at this U-tube, the original meaning of U-tube, piece of glass shaped like a U, and there's a membrane at the bottom. So the two halves of the U shape are two subcompartments. There's a selectively permeable membrane in place, and there is water, which is solvent, so there's the potential for osmosis to occur. It fulfills both requirements. Let's look at what we have originally, though. On the left side, before I even describe this, let me tell you something about the definition of osmosis. I haven't really defined it yet. And I notice that a lot of books phrase this in a way that is potentially confusing. A lot of textbooks will say something like, osmosis is movement of water from a place of low solute concentration to a place of high solute concentration. You ever come across a definition like that? Okay. Well, that is true. It is true as long as there's a membrane involved. but it's kind of a backwards way of saying it that is confusing because it makes it sound like it's an exception to passive transport always moving from high to low concentration. But think about what it means to say water is moving from a low solute concentration to a high solute concentration. If water is at a low solute concentration, then that means the solution that solution there is very watery. Low solute concentration means high water concentration. Right? And if it moves from there to a place where there's high solute concentration, well, another way of saying high solute concentration is low water concentration. The stronger you have solutes, stronger the concentration is for solutes, the lower the concentration is for solvent. You see why that's backward sounding? It's not really an exception, though. It's still passive transport. Water, just like anything moving passively, is going down its gradient. It's the only way things can move passively, down their gradients. So, looking at this YouTube again, on the left side, before we let this run, the concentration of solutes is low on the left half, which means this is more watery, right? And the right half has a higher solute concentration, which means it's not as watery. Therefore, for the water gradient, which is the only thing that matters, remember, water is moving only because of its own gradient. Osmosis always occurs, and the definition I think should be written better as movement of water through a semipermeable membrane from a place of high water concentration to a place of low water concentration, because that's really what's happening. And it's less confusing that way, at least in my mind it is. And that's what's going to happen here. The gradient for water is from left to right. There's high concentration on the left of water, low concentration on right. So water's always going to move to where it is less watery, lower concentration of water. In that case, water's going to go through the membrane from left to right, and the green particles, whatever they are, the solute, can't get through. That's the selective permeability of the membrane. It doesn't allow both through, just the water. So there's a green molecule gradient. The green molecules want to move down their own gradient, which would be from right to left, but they're blocked, so they can't. That means water will be taken out of the left half, put into the right half, but nothing will replace it. And that's why the overall liquid level drops on the left and rises on the right. Now, this has come to equilibrium, and it's probably because of the elimination of the gradient, because it looks now equally watery on both sides, right? If the water gradient becomes zero, there will be no more tendency to move in one direction than another for water, and therefore it will stop osmosing. There's still movement of water molecules, but they're going right to left as much as they are left to right. So it's no more net osmosis. That's one way it can get to equilibrium, by elimination of the gradient, as we talked about before. But there's another way this can happen, and you have to imagine this because I don't have a picture. So let's set this up exactly the same way, the U-tube, except in the left half, it's pure water, no solute at all. You still have a gradient for water that wants to move from left to right, correct, if this is pure water. But as water leaves the left half from pure water and goes into here, it's diluting this side. This is becoming more watery on the right. But it's never going to get as watery as pure water on the left that it's leaving behind, right? So the gradient is never going to be eliminated. You have some solutes here. No matter how much water you add, you're still going to have a little less than pure water. Does that make sense? So there's always going to be a tendency for water to continue going from left to right. But it will come to equilibrium even though the concentration gradient isn't eliminated. And that's because as the level changes and the liquid level gets higher on the right, that becomes a heavier column of liquid. Gravity's pulling down more on this higher column. And when the force of gravity, which is trying to force it backwards in exactly the opposite direction that it's osmosing, when the force of gravity exactly equals the force of osmosis, then it will come to equilibrium for a different reason. The concentration gradient will still be in place. It'll be diminished based on what it was originally. It can never be eliminated, but it will still come to equilibrium. Alrighty. The reason this applies to yours is because the membrane, which is artificial here, the membrane that matters in your experiment is the plasma membrane of plant cells, specifically the plant cells in your cut-up pieces of potato. That brings us to 12, which involves some more definitions. We see here three different levels of tonicity. Tonicity is a general word that refers to the tendency for osmosis to occur, either into or out of a cell. So that's the general term, but you see on the headings here that there are three categories of tonicity: hypotonicity, isotonicity, hypertonicity, or the corresponding adjectives hypotonic, isotonic, hypertonic. Now listen carefully, because this is also not only potentially confusing, but this is also something that the author of the manual gets wrong. So beware of this in her writing in the manual. What I'm going to say is what you need to know as the fact. And what she gets wrong is that these words, hypotonic, isotonic, and hypertonic, should never be used to describe a cell. These words should only be used to describe the environment that is surrounding the cell, not the cell itself. Okay, so you always use these words to describe the external solution, not the cell. Beware of that, because she might say just the opposite in the manual, but that's wrong. All right, now the other part that's confusing because of the way these words are used is that even though it's the water gradient that matters, that's what causes water to move by osmosis, not the solutes, but the water gradient. Even though that's true, the prefixes used in these words refer to the solutes rather than the water. And so it's backwards again in the way it seems. Let me explain what I mean. Hypo means what as a prefix? It means below. Hypodermic means below the skin. Iso means same. And hyper means above. Hyperactive, being more active than you should be. Okay. These prefixes describe solute concentrations, not water concentrations. So it's exactly backwards. The first solution on the left is called a hypotonic solution. Now, a solution by itself would never be called this. You would only use the word hypotonic or any of these other tonic words if there are cells immersed in that solution. So these words are really, they're describing the solution, but they're describing the solution in relation to the cell itself that's in there. Okay? A hypotonic solution is one that has a lower overall solute concentration than the fluid in the cell does. Now, that's why it was called hypo. Hypo means lower, and it's true that a hypotonic solution has a lower solute concentration than the cell does, but that's a backwards way of saying that a hypotonic solution is more watery than the cell, right? Because a lower solute concentration means a higher water concentration. So always think of a hypotonic solution as being more watery than the solution inside the cell. The word hypotonic by itself means that there is a water gradient across the membrane, right? Because if it's more watery outside the cell than it is inside the cell, there is a gradient for water. Well, in all cases of osmosis, water is going to move from high water concentration to low water concentration. It's always going to move from where it's more watery to where it's less watery. Since a hypotonic solution is more watery than the cell, a cell that's in a hypotonic solution will take in water because that's the way the water's going. It's going down its gradient into the cell. We have an animal cell, a red blood cell representing an animal cell. If it's placed in a hypotonic environment, that's bad news for the cell because we animals, as I was talking about upstairs, only have a plasma membrane, which is pretty flimsy. We don't have a cell wall outside of that. As water comes in, it's increasing the volume of the cell, and therefore the cell is going to swell. If it's hypotonic enough, that means water will come in to the extent of bursting the cell. And that bursting is called lysis. Remember I said that lysis means splitting. Like in lysosome and hydrolysis. Well, I shouldn't have to tell you that that is not good for the animal cell. It kills the animal cell. So animal cells don't do well in a hypotonic environment. Let's look at the other extreme before we go to the middle. Hypertonic describes a solution that has a higher solute concentration than the cell does. But that is just a backwards way of saying that a hypertonic solution is one that is less watery than the cell is. So once again, you have a water concentration gradient in place, and therefore a tendency for osmosis, but it's in exactly the reverse direction. Still, water is going to go to where it's more watery, but in this case, it's more watery outside the cell. So an animal cell in a hypertonic environment is going to lose water by osmosis. That's going to cause the cell to shrivel. That shriveling gets a specific name, which is crenation, with an N. Crenation is also bad for the cell. It will kill the cell if it shrivels enough. So animal cells don't do well in either extreme. The middle is an isotonic solution. Now, I said that iso means equal. But there's an important thing to say about that. An isotonic solution is simply one that has an equal overall solute concentration compared to the cell. That's just another way of saying that the isotonic solution is just as watery as the cell is. But the solutes in an isotonic solution don't at all have to be the same kinds of solutes as what are in the cell. Because remember, the solute gradients are not what matters. It's the water gradient. So for instance, if you have, well, today you're using what as your solute in your environment? What are your solutions? Sucrose, table sugar. That table sugar is one kind of solute. The main, there's different solutes inside the cells, including starch. That's a totally different solute, right? So you can have totally different solutes on the other sides of the membrane, but if they're equal concentrations overall, that means the wateriness is equal. And that's what matters to whether osmosis is going to occur or not. Okay? If there's equal wateriness outside and inside the cell, that's an isotonic solution, and therefore no gradient for water, no tendency for net diffuse or for net osmosis. But that doesn't mean no water moves. Water is still moving. It's just moving into and out of the cell at the same rate. And therefore, the volume of the cell does not change over time. And it remains a nice, healthy erythrocyte or red blood cell, as you see in the picture. Animal cells do well in an isotonic environment. Now let's compare this to plants on the bottom row. The words for the tonicity mean exactly the same thing for plants as animals. But if you put a plant cell into a hypotonic environment, which by definition is more watery than the plant cell, it's going to take in water just like an animal cell will, but because it has that strong, thick cell wall outside of its cell membrane, plasma membrane, that cell wall will hold the pressure. Osmosis is going to want to keep bringing water in, but once the cell wall presses back with just as much force as the force of water coming in, it will come to equilibrium. The cell will be swollen, though, or turgid, nice and tight. That's the ideal situation for a plant cell. Plants do best in a hypotonic environment, which, by the way, you introduce to a plant when you water it. When you water a plant, you're making the environment hypotonic. And water will enter the cells of the plant by osmosis. Now, this is a single cell, but a plant is made up of millions and millions of cells. Each one is individually swelling, but they're connected to each other by the cell wall between them, right? So in a population of millions of cells, each individually swell, they push on each other, and that causes an erection. Very similar to an erection in a penis, but that's caused by blood pressure. In a plant, it's caused by osmotic pressure. And that's why if you forget to water a new plant that has a green stem, it's just going to sag, it's going to wilt, because you've turned the environment into isotonic. In the isotonic solution, the plant survives that, at least for now, but it's no longer turgid. They're no longer pressing on each other. The plant can't stand up. If you put a plant cell into a hypertonic solution, though, it's going to lose water for the same reason an animal cell does. But that's going to be bad news. It's not going to cause crenation. That's the shriveling of an animal cell specifically. What happens for a plant cell in a hypertonic environment is that the water that leaves, which is inside the plasma membrane, is going to decrease the volume of that cell, and that's going to cause the plasma membrane to peel away from the inner surface of the cell wall. The cell wall is pretty rigid, so it stays in place. The cell wall is like the structural wall of the room, and the plasma membrane is like the paint on the inside of the wall. The plasma membrane is peeling away, leaving the cell wall behind, and that's called plasmolysis as a process. The verb is plasmolyzed. The past tense verb is plasmolyzed. That will kill the plant cell. Just be careful with the word plasmolysis, because even though it includes this lysis term, it's happening for exactly this opposite reason as lysis in an animal cell. Plasmolysis is analogous to crenation. Happens for a plant cell in a hypertonic environment, not hypotonic. Okay, any questions on those slides? Then I'm done with that, but I'm not done talking to you because I want to say more about this experiment and the report. One thing, I'm remembering not to forget to talk about these whiteboards. So you need to get your final measurements once I shut up. And by the way, it doesn't matter at all what it says to wait for in the manual. Whenever I'm done talking, that's the end period, end of waiting period. So you get your final masses, and make sure you write those down, and everyone in your group has them. But you're not, other than cleaning up, you're not yet quite ready to go. There's other things you have to look at or do. One of them is to make a little drawing on the whiteboard that you have sitting here. One per group. You just have to make one. That's not an individual thing, but it's one per group. And the instructions for what you're supposed to draw in there is, you can follow those. But make sure you approve it with me before you leave. The reason this is so important is because you need to take a picture. Everyone needs to take a picture of that group's whiteboard once I've approved it. Because if you insert that into your report too, you'll get bonus points. Don't waste those. Okay, so ask me if you have questions about the drawing. The things you have to look at are over here, and I don't know why this confuses so many people, but it looks like you have two strawberry dishes here, right? Yes, in reality, it's two dishes. But they're labeled after and before. So it really represents the same dish at two different times. Realize that. Don't think of this as two dishes, and the same for the raisins. But observe those and make sense of it before you leave. Now, for the report itself, there are specific instructions at the end of the chapter, just like there was for the first report. And just like for the first report, no matter what it says in the manual, you are not giving me a hard copy. You're doing it in Word, incorporating your images into the Word, and uploading through Canvas just one document. Also, just like the first report, you have to make a graph. And that's what I'm going to tell you exactly how to do this. Just as I do every term. And every term, there are many people who just don't bother listening to these explicit directions, and they lose a lot of points. Just like a lot of people did for the first one, by the way. I said a lot of you were going to do this, and a lot of you did exactly that. So that's what it's. You need to listen to these recordings, is the point. Anyway, when you graph this, it's pretty straightforward, except for one thing that a lot of people don't get, and that's why I want to tell you exactly what's going on here. Let me just draw some fake data, graph them. Yours might not look like this at all, but let's just put some raw data down there. What's the dependent variable? What is it? No, I mean specifically on this graph. What are you graphing on the y-axis? Change in mass, not mass. So that's one thing you can do wrong. You're getting two masses today, right? Initial and final. What you need to graph is change in mass. And in science, we use delta for change. Change in mass, or delta mass, mathematically, you could compute that two different ways, right? A minus B or B minus A. would both be a difference. But there's one proper way to do that. A change in mass should always be, mass final minus mass initial. Not the other way around. The reason it matters is because if your final mass is bigger than your initial mass, what does that just mean in common sense terms, first of all? Why would your final mass be bigger? What would cause that to happen? What did it gain?
Water.
By osmosis. But yes, the final mass being bigger means that if you calculate it this way, big minus small is going to be a positive number. So a positive change in mass means a gain in water. Whereas if your final is smaller than your initial, small minus big is going to give you a negative number. Only if you do it according to this formula are you going to get the right sign. The sign matters as much as the magnitude, the value of the number matters. Okay? But you're not graphing final mass or initial mass. You're calculating change in mass, and the change in mass that you are putting on your y-axis. Now notice that a change in mass can be positive, zero, or negative. So don't just follow your instincts and think that zero is going to be down here. There are negative numbers possible. So zero will be somewhere in here. You'll have negative numbers, positive numbers. All right? What is the independent variable? What is it? What about the solutions? You use the same solution in all three. That's not the variable. It's not the type of solution, in other words. What is it about the solution that changes? The concentration. Right. And what are the concentrations measured in? For today. Molar. Not moles. Molar is moles of solute per liter of solution, remember. So you'll have concentration, and in parentheses, molar. And once again, these are numeric values, so use a number line, not a categorical axis like I said some of you would do last time and some of you did. What are your three values? For concentration? Zero. What's the middle one? I can't hear you over this fan. 0.3 molar and 0.5, is it? Okay. So this is wrong. Those are not evenly spaced, right? Don't do that. That'll mess everything up if you do that. Anyway, I made too many data points. You're not actually making that many measurements. So you have 3 points here. Let me just put 3 quick points, though. They're not perfectly linear, as you would expect for real values, but it looks like they're close to being linear, so you're justified in drawing a line of best fit, only a better one, more careful, with a ruler. Now to the part that is not understandable. Remember that lines of best fit are not just things to look at. They are tools for which you can use them for interpolation, right? Which is prediction. Prediction of values that you didn't actually measure, right? That's what interpolation is in general. Well, there is a specific question on the report asking you to use your graph to figure out what the solute concentration of the potato cells is. You are not measuring any concentrations, right? So how in the hell would you get that, might be your question. And that, this is the part that people don't tend to understand, so I'm just telling you. This has to do with the definitions of tonicity that I just gave you. What does it mean for a solution in your experiment today to be isotonic? According to my definition. You're right. I told you to remember it that way. It is true that it's equally watery outside as inside. But the only way that'll happen is if the environment has the same overall solute concentration as the potato cell has. All right? Now, this graph doesn't involve potato concentrations at all. This involves environment concentrations, right? None of your three, it's likely that none of your three solutions is going to be isotonic. What would have to be true if it's truly isotonic? Yes, exactly. If it's an isotonic solution, that means the change in mass would be zero. It wouldn't gain or lose water if it's isotonic. And it's probable, like I said, that none of these three points is going to be zero change in mass. But when the question asks you to figure out what the concentration of potatoes is, it's an indirect way of asking you to use your line of best fit to figure out what the concentration of an isotonic solution is. Because the concentration of an isotonic solution, by definition, is the same as the concentration of the potato. Therefore, you just use interpolation. In this case, you start at zero on the y-axis, and you go over to the line of best fit, and then straight down and read that concentration. That's the concentration that you would expect to give you zero change in mass, which would be an isotonic solution, and therefore that's what the potato concentration should be. Does everyone understand that? And is everyone going to do this now that I've told you exactly how to do it? I hope so, but it's never happened. Okay, any questions about the report that you didn't learn from doing the first one? It's worth a little bit more, so pay attention to the date. I give you plenty of time to do it. Don't really worry about it at all until after the upcoming test. That's more valuable. Okay, I don't know what the date is, but it's after the test. So get your data here today, draw your pictures, look at the stuff, make sure everyone has a picture of the whiteboard once I approve it, make sure everyone has the raw data, and then clean up appropriately. That's it.